pressure flow times resistance. Is this a flow problem or is this a resistance problem?
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
So Alice, what are we talking about today?
Today is part two of our congenital diaphragmatic hernia series. Today we're talking about neonatal resuscitation, what you do in the delivery room and beyond, and how you decide about when to cannulate them onto ECMO. Zach, who did you recruit to talk about this with us?
We are excited to have Dr. Amir Ashrafi and Dr. Yeet Gunner back with us on the podcast. Starting with Dr. Gunner, he's an assistant professor of surgery at UC Irvine and a pediatric surgeon at Children's Hospital of Orange County. He is well known for his work in congenital diaphragmatic hernia, including being the first author on the ELSO CDH guidelines.
Yes, another guideline author whose brain we get to pick. We also have Dr. Amir Ashrafi with us today. He is a fully double-boarded neonatal cardiologist. He did NICU at UCLA and cardiology at Boston Children's, after which he came back to practice at the Children's Hospital of Orange County. Dr. Ashrafi obviously has a specific interest in infants with congenital heart disease. He's also the co-founder of the NeoHeart Conference, which tackles these issues in depth.
Yes, this is a great episode. We go right to the bedside of managing the sick patients and that nearly impossible question of when should we pull the trigger on going on to ECMO. Let's get right to it. Let me update our case and we'll keep progressing along. So our baby who is at term and was scheduled to be delivered today, everyone's in the OR. We're going in for our repeat C-section. The NICU team's there. All the other support staff is there. Certainly the surgeons are aware that this patient's about to be delivered. So the baby is delivered. Dr. Ashrafi, I'd just like to get your mental model of, you know, what are the CDH-specific considerations for approaching this high-risk delivery?
So first and foremost, you want to have your team there, of course. Nursing team, OB team, neonatal team. When they deliver the baby and send it over to us, the first thing we're going to do is try to intubate that baby as quickly as possible. The idea being that if baby starts to cry, starts to swallow air, that's only going to expand the stomach, which is already in the chest, which is already occupying any lung mechanics that can take place. So let's eliminate that problem right from the get-go. Drop in a breathing tube. We don't necessarily need to use particularly high pressures. And in fact, one of the things that was oftentimes thought of in the beginning is we really need high pressures to try to inflate these alveoli. Mm. But we realize now that that causes far more harm than benefit with volutrauma and barotrauma that takes place. So just get them in, try to establish FRC best you can. Of course, that's hard to do in a delivery room. Your resources are limited. You also want to put an NG tube in, suck out any additional air that can be taking place. Maybe put it to continuous suction. Don't let that stomach, don't let those intestines in the chest inflate. And really try to get out as quickly and as safely as possible. That's ideal scenario. Get the baby to the NICU, and then go from there.
Nice.
Much of this nowadays is in the form of a standardized clinical pathway or clinical practice guidelines that exist for every patient.
So every site would have their own clinical pathway, I would imagine, and how these multidisciplinary teams care for these high-risk patients. Is that correct?
That's correct. But much of this is similar, and initial aspects that Amir mentioned all come from Dr. Charlie Stoller's work of gentle ventilation. Controlling the airway, all that stuff, I think, has become standard.
Nice.
And I'd like us to talk more about that. So Dr. Ashrafi, you get this neonate to the NICU. I'd like to know, how do you set your gas exchange goals, you know, that being saturations, CO2 goals, and then how are you going to set up that ventilator for this patient at such high risk for baro and volutrauma?
Excellent question. There's been a lot of work on this over the years, and Dr. Gunner mentioned Charlie Stoller. He's done more for our understanding of this disease process than just about anybody. And this is one of those really cool collaborative moments between neonatology and ped surgery where we each help each other get better. There is some good data that your first blood gas, specifically your PCO2 on your first blood gas, is a very important indicator of whether your baby's going to survive or not. If your first blood gas has a PCO2 of 120, you're probably not going to make it very far. And so really, I think that kind of goes without saying. So right from the get-go, we want to establish FRC. More often than not, we will try with tidal volume ventilation. SIMV is typically what we use. Again, there's some good studies in the NICU world that intermittent ventilation is better for alveolar growth than an oscillator per se, which is just a consistent mean airway pressure. However, the oscillator is very effective at ventilation. And so if we're unable to get gas exchange with intermittent ventilation, we will quickly move to an oscillator there. In terms of goals, permissive hypercapnia is something that's become essentially standard of care. We're not aiming for a 7440 patient. We know that the neonatal myocardium, for example, is very resilient to acidosis. These babies were living in pHs of 7.1, 7.2 for 9 months gestation. So they're going to do okay for a short time period with a 7.20. And so we will tolerate 7.20, 7.25. We'll allow PCO2s to climb in an attempt not to damage whatever lung parenchyma is there. They're already starting behind the eight ball. They're missing at least one lung, if not one and a half. And so we don't want to damage whatever is there. So permissive hypercapnia. With regards to oxygen goals, really whatever it takes to meet the metabolic demands of the body. Oftentimes we'll let these oxygen saturations in the preductal symmetry, 88 and higher or so, 85 and higher, making sure that we keep that hemoglobin high. We do routinely put NIRS on. We don't routinely use EEGs unless necessary, but our cerebral monitoring is with NIRS predominantly. And postductally, we'll let it drop to 75, 80, something to that effect, as long as our hemoglobin is high. And there's no evidence of end organ dysfunction. But that's our initial hemodynamic strategy. And again, I'm not advocating for a 75 postductally. I don't want your viewers to take away and say, that's great. But in the initial transitional period, we'll allow a little permissive hypercapnia, a little permissive hypoxia in the beginning. And hopefully over the next hours or so, as we recruit more alveoli, those will get better.
This seems like a patient where you'd really would like to have a right upper extremity arterial line and an umbilical arterial line to really measure your PaO2 precisely. Is that correct?
That would be ideal, but we don't do that routinely. We usually just have a postductal umbilical art line catheter, yeah. And then we do everything based on saturations.
Mm. Certainly.
More so than PaO2.
Sometimes some of these things are ideal, but they're not always possible.
I understand.
Depends on the baby's size and other issues. Immediately possible.
Yes. So, Dr. Ashrafi, you mentioned the oscillator, and I'd be interested to know, how do you inform your decision about this patient who perhaps is on high peak pressures? And when do you know when to pull the trigger on something like the oscillator or perhaps even in jet ventilation?
Now, I've had the good pleasure of doing med school and residency and a couple of fellowships all in different locations. And I have never seen a jet ventilator used ever. I could have a jet ventilator sitting right next to me right now, and I wouldn't know that that's what a jet ventilator is. So I can't speak very intelligently about jet ventilators, so I apologize. I've just never seen one. But with regards to oscillators, we have arbitrarily decided, and it's founded in some data. I wouldn't say it's great data, but we've arbitrarily decided if you're requiring peak pressures greater than 25 to maybe 26, then maybe you're getting a little more volutrauma or barotrauma than it's worth it. So then we'll move to an oscillator at that point in time.
Nice.
You know, this is very obvious when you're looking at a meconium aspiration baby. You look at the ventilator settings, they're very different than a CDH baby who's failing both the oscillator or the conventional ventilator. Those settings are lower for a CDH baby, so we don't crank up the mechanical ventilation, and our oscillator values are significantly lower when we go to the oscillator compared to a different, like a septic baby, for example.
Certainly. So we talked a lot about the respiratory support for these patients. I'd like to now transition to the hemodynamic resuscitation. How do you manage a patient who's in shock in front of you? So say this patient's having, of course, hypoxemia, but also hypotension. Is there any CDH-specific approach that you have for a patient in shock, improving their hemodynamics?
Excellent question. This is something that, is always fun for ICU providers to manage. And you're talking about a very interesting physiology. What do you do for the patient who's in a high PVR state, but a low SVR state? Well, actually, let me back up a sec. Why are they hypotensive? Is it low cardiac output? Actually, let me back up even further. Pressure, flow times resistance. Is this a flow problem or is this a resistance problem? Is this cardiac output or is this SVR? If it is an SVR issue, then it's when it gets interesting. You now have a patient with a high PVR state and a low SVR state. So what is the right thing to do in that scenario? Volume, volume, volume is usually everybody's first three moves in a low SVR state. But that can be problematic in a baby whose lungs are not, not primed to work well. The last thing in the world you want is a whole lot of pulmonary edema. So in these kids, we try to keep their fluids pretty tight.
Yeah.
So now you start asking yourself, well, which vasoactive meds, specifically which vasopressors are ideal? Norepi can be great for your SVR, but terrible for your PVR. Is low dose epi the right answer? We more and more in the neonatal world are starting to use vasopressin for babies like this. The idea being that you vasoconstrict peripherally, you vasodilate centrally. It doesn't make your pulmonary hypertension worse. So if that's the source of our shock and it's a low SVR, then we'll vasopressin, maybe a little low dose epi, but we'll try to avoid DOPA at all costs. We'll avoid norepi at all costs and whatnot. On the flip side, if we think the state of shock is a low cardiac output state with normal SVR, well, then that's going to be completely different. Then we're going to start using more inotropes, more beta agents, and we'll do what we need there. Our institution is unique in that myself and a few others, we do our own echoes as well. And so we use echoes, neonatologist performed echoes, pretty similar to the way we use blood gases, for example. If you make a change on a ventilator and you get a blood gas an hour later to make sure you cleared that CO2, we use echo that way, not to diagnose structural heart disease. We let cardiologists do that, but to guide our hemodynamic management. So if we do start, I'm making this up, a little low dose epi because of LV dysfunction, well, then we'll do a neonatologist performed echo an hour later and make sure, did our LV output actually get better? If we started this vasoactive or this pulmonary vasodilator, did it actually have improvements an hour later? And we have a fourth year fellowship specifically on neonatal hemodynamics. And so we'll oftentimes park our fourth year fellow there, and they're just doing echoes multiple times a day, making sure we got the hemodynamics exactly right on these patients.
Wow. That's what an amazing and clean way to reassess shock. Is this on the cardiac side and in the general NICU? And is this the 74 cardiologist approved echo sequences, or is this more of a focused cardiac ultrasound?
I have no idea what the 74
Is this like a cardiologist echocardiogram, or is this a focused cardiac ultrasound?
It is a focused neonatal, what we call a targeted neonatal echo. We're not looking for anatomic heart disease. We will let our cardiologists look for coronaries and you know, mitral valve disease. We are specifically looking at hemodynamics. We're looking at RV output, RV performance, LV output, surrogates of SVR. What becomes critically important in the immediate postoperative period, and there was just a paper published on this just in the last month or so, is what is the ductal shunting that takes place in these babies? If your ductal shunt is all left to right, then that tells you there's probably more than enough pulmonary vascular bed growth that's taken place that these babies are going to do fine. On the flip side, if your duct is all right to left, that tells you that, wait a sec, this baby's got a very high PVR state. This may just be hypoxic vasoconstriction, could just be transitional physiology that's going to take time, or is it severe vascular hypoplasia? We need to watch out for these kids quite closely. And then, of course, the most confusing ones are the ones with bidirectional flow, and you don't exactly know which way it's going to play out over time. So we routinely get echoes and follow, amongst all the other things, ductal shunt position. If the ductal shunt is all right to left, then one thing that we've started to do, and I think it's new in management of CDH, is we don't let that duct close. We'll start these kids on prostaglandin. And that's what I meant earlier when I was saying that CDH, in particular severe CDH, is becoming a ductal-dependent lesion. It's starting to be recognized as a ductal-dependent lesion, because if it's all right to left, the worst thing you can do is let that duct close. That's going to be tremendous afterload on this RV, and you're going to get RV failure, and you're going to call your surgeon to put this kid on ECMO. But if we can keep that duct open in this particular scenario, then we'll maintain stable, well, a relatively stable circulation, relatively stable perfusion, hopefully avoid ECMO, and work on what needs to be done to drop this PVR, if at all possible.
Amir, would you like to talk about my favorite drug?
And then, of course, Milrinone.
I can't tell if you're kidding or serious, Dr. Gunner.
No, he's totally serious.
Okay.
Milrinone is something that Dr. Gunner saw. It's always great when your surgeon comes by and I was like, did you do Milrinone? And I have to embarrassingly go, oh my God, I didn't even think about that. No, I didn't. So it's actually kind of awesome. One of the things your podcaster should see is the dynamic between myself and Dr. Gunner. Every time we have the CDH patients, we're always trying to one-up each other. He's trying to one-up me on medical things. I'm trying to one-up him on surgical things. And it's actually a comedy show. But yes, Milrinone, absolutely. Milrinone has got multiple benefits. Of course, it's going to pulmonary vasodilate to an extent, without a doubt. But in these babies with severe CDH who do have this stiff LV, they do have this component of diastolic dysfunction, and you do have this theoretic lusitropic effect of Milrinone, it actually can be quite ideal for this particular patient population. There's been a couple of studies that have come out. One of Yeet's good friends is Neil Patel out in Glasgow, if I'm not mistaken. And he's shown that, and there's been several studies since then have shown, LV dysfunction is a very potent marker of babies who are going to need ECMO. And specifically, if your cardiac output drops below, and I'm doing this off of memory, so I hope I'm right, 1.4 liters per minute per meter squared, your risk of ECMO goes through the roof. And so if you can maintain cardiac output with something like milrinone, can you mitigate the need for ECMO? Now, that's never been studied in a randomized controlled trial, but it definitely makes a lot of sense. There's a gentleman named Satyan out of UC Davis who's been trying to start a national study looking specifically at milrinone in these high-risk patients because of all the potential benefits that it does have.
That's fascinating.
How about nitric?
Did I say it, Gunnar? Did I say it right?
You can one-up him.
How about nitric?
That's going to be our next question. So it seems like, Dr. Ashrafi, if I understand correctly, if these patients have really high pulmonary vascular resistance and having RV dysfunction, maintaining that ductus with PGE certainly is an important concept. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, this RV's been conditioned to see systemic SVR for 9 months gestation. So it's not like a five-year-old's RV. These RVs are thick, they're muscle-bound, they're conditioned to see this afterload. However, we do know that the RV is distinctly different than the LV in multiple realms. We know that, number one, from its three-dimensional shape, it's more triangular shape rather than conical shape like the LV. And if you just talk to any physicist, a conical shape structure can generate substantially more force than a triangular shape structure. Number one, it's substantially less compact. So you've got less muscle fibers per square unit of area on the RV than you do on the LV. But what's also interesting about the RV is muscle fiber orientation. In the neonatal RV in particular, 80% of the muscle fibers are oriented in the longitudinal direction. When you compare that with the LV, that's equally distributed between the X, Y, and Z axis, so that when the LV contracts, it contracts in two planes, both longitudinally and circumferentially. Whereas the LV can only, well, 80% is only in the longitudinal direction, which makes it very afterload sensitive. So as long as this conditioned RV is seeing SVR, systemic vascular resistance, you're going to be fine. If that duct closes and you now start to see super systemic PVR, that RV is going to fail in no time. And oftentimes these kids need ECMO.
Very fast.
I oftentimes tell my fellows, and I'm a little tongue-in-cheek when I say it, but I'm exaggerating, but the point, you'll get the point. If a baby goes on to ECMO with diaphragmatic hernia because of right heart failure, the doctor messed up. It's not the baby. This baby should never, his RV or his or her RV should never see suprasystemic pressures. You shouldn't allow that to happen.
That's fascinating.
Wow.
And then a question about milrinone. It's clear to me if you have LV dysfunction, milrinone might be worth a shot, whether it's diastolic dysfunction or systolic dysfunction. Would you use milrinone in a patient who just has right-sided dysfunction?
We have. And it's worked incredibly well.
That's really neat. So at this point, let's transition to managing pulmonary vascular resistance. And in my understanding with congenital diaphragmatic hernia, there's a certain component of fixed and irreversible pulmonary vascular resistance. And there's also this other aspect of reversible. I'd just like to get your idea of how you utilize options like nitric oxide and other pulmonary vasodilators.
So if I were to give you the textbook answer, nitric oxide is bad. There's never been a study showing that nitric oxide helps babies with diaphragmatic hernia. There's a publication just in the last week or two that shows, there's been multiple publications, there's just one most recently published, that shows the use of nitric oxide either doesn't help or increases ECMO and increases mortality.
Wow.
Gunnar and I have been trying to get involved into a study that's looking at exactly this topic. However, I don't think it's that simple. And again, I think that if nitric oxide fails, it's not the drug, it's the ICU's provider's inability to understand the hemodynamic impact of a pulmonary vasodilator in this condition. So what do I mean by that? When you look at a baby with CDH, there's going to be multiple reasons for their pulmonary hypertension. You're going to have vascular hypoplasia. No amount of nitric oxide is going to help that. So fixed to your point that you had mentioned, Zach. You're going to get the muscular layer is going to hypertrophy. And when blood vessels hypertrophy, they don't hypertrophy out, they hypertrophy in. As they hypertrophy in, reduction in interluminal diameter, there's no amount of nitric oxide that's going to help that. So fixed, to your point, there's nothing you can do. However, is there a component of hypoxic vasoconstriction that's taking place? Is there a component that is dynamic? Well, it's reasonable to think yes. So that's why everybody does nitric oxide, hoping that you're going to at least get some bang for your buck there. And you use it, you may have benefit in the, you know, in the immediate minutes or hours after using it, but then over the course of hours and days, mortality goes up, ECMO goes up. The question is why? What was it about the pulmonary vasodilator that was so problematic? Now, this is completely my biased opinion. There's limited science to support what I'm saying. This is 100% my opinion. But if you do have, let's take grandmom who's in a MICU, who's got diastolic heart failure, and I hate to be crude, but what's the best way to kill grandmom? with diastolic heart failure is give her a whole bunch of volume. Mm-hmm. That LV explodes. She gets pulmonary edema and grandmom unfortunately passes away. That's the best way to kill grandmom or grandpa who's got diastolic heart failure. So now let's translate that to our patient. You have a baby with a small, stiff left ventricle for conditions we talked about earlier. You now give them a pulmonary vasodilator. There is a dynamic component. You increase pulmonary blood flow. You increase pulmonary venous return. But now this left heart can't tolerate that volume burden. So what happens? Well, now you have the fourth mechanism of pulmonary hypertension that we talked about. Now you get increase in your LVEDP, left atrial hypertension, leads to pulmonary venous hypertension. And is it the combination of arterial and venous hypertension that causes these kids to crash onto ECMO after starting nitric oxide? I do think that may be it. So when we talk about CDH, and particularly severe CDH being a ductal-dependent lesion, I think it's twofold. Number one, you want to pressure offload the RV. But number two, you also volume offload the LV, meaning whatever nitric oxide you give, some blood will go to the LV that can tolerate. Whatever the LV can't tolerate, you still have that volume pop off from the setting of the duct. So with our center, when we do give nitric oxide, again, we have the luxury of doing our own echoes. We'll do 3 to 4 echoes a day, every day on these kids. We are very clear to look at how this LV is impacted by the initiation of any pulmonary vasodilator, whether it be milrinone, nitric, sildenafil, et cetera.
That's awesome.
And I will add one thing. There is the academic way of looking at things, which are very accurate, as Amir said, and as I think we've evolved to understand it in the last 5-10 years. But most babies who are crashing universally end up on nitric oxide. Now, I'll say one other thing. If I'm an expert on one thing, I'll say I'm an expert on the ELSO data on diaphragmatic hernia. And not every baby, at least the way it's coded in ELSO, ends up on extracorporeal life support and is on pre-ECMO nitric oxide. Now, why would centers not put them on nitric oxide? Do they know better? Do they not have it? Did they not code it?
Oh.
I'm going to assume they know better. Some centers know better. And I really think this is sort of the difference of some of the centers with great outcomes is they don't wait too long to go on ECMO. They know their patients, they know their results, they know the phenotype, and they don't chase the disease till it fails to go on ECMO. And you can say, well, then they just do too much ECMO. Maybe it's true, but maybe they save some babies in doing too much ECMO. That's sort of where my mind is at.
Yes.
Do you think it gets as early as my first CO2 is 150? Let's get the pump ready.
Well, I've seen what can be done with excellent critical care. And you know, we all receive babies in extremis from many other centers. And, you know, within a few hours, they're better. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, you know, that assuming things. And I'm not saying other centers can't do a great job, regional centers and et cetera. But I would not agree with that statement that just go that early. But
yeah.
Maybe I'll give you another example. For example, you have a baby who is resuscitated well, but slowly starts creeping up. It's not hypotensive, but on certain medications, a number of them we discussed so far, maybe all of them. And the FiO2 is 80%. Next day it's 90%. Third day it's 100%. But you're still like, your gases are perfect.
It's not sustainable.
Do you wait a fourth day? Do you wait a fifth day? Mm-hmm. So this, I think that's the art. That's the art, and that's the complexity, and that's where expertise comes from in knowing I'm not going to tolerate 100% oxygen for more than 4 to 6 to 12 hours, even though the gases are perfect. So that's, I think that's what happens is the better you get at critical care, you start having babies who are on paper not failing.
Yeah. Let's think about our case. Say we have this child of the NICU, CDH. Dr. Ashrafi is giving us excellent critical care, but despite all of the medicines, the numbers are looking a little bit worse. Can both of you take a complex topic that is when to pull the trigger on cannulation for ECMO? Can you take this complex topic and try to distill it down? When typically do you reach for ECMO in these patients?
Well, I'm going to interrupt Amir. I'm going to say something very quick. I actually can't give you an answer. But I'll let Amir tell. I mean, that's my answer to that question. But Amir, you go for it.
My answer is similar to that. Oftentimes you hear people talk about OIs. I don't know if that's a NICU thing or a PICU thing. I don't know if you guys deal with OIs in your
PICU
world.
Every once in a while. Calculator.
Every once in a while. Yeah. Here's my take on OIs. I remember I was brand new attending. I couldn't have been attending for more than 2 to 3 months. And there was this kid who clearly, in my opinion, needed ECMO. It wasn't a CDH, it was something else. I forget what it was. So I called the surgeon at 2-3 in the morning and I said, hey, you know, I think this kid needs to go on ECMO. And of course, the surgeon's like, who are you and why are you calling me? Oh, I'm the new attending and here's what's going on. What's your OI? And I forget what I said. I had said a number. And the person's like, oh, we don't do that. We don't put ECMO for OIs that level here. Keep doing what you're doing. And kind of hangs up. So I said, all right, that's weird. No problem. I can fix that. I cranked up the FiO2. I cranked up the oxygen. Back. I got my gosh. 30 minutes later, I got a blood gas. I called the same person back. I was like, my OI is now fill in the blank. He's like, oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, then we should go on ECMO. I'm like, okay, thank you. So obviously it wasn't Dr. Gunner, but I think a lot of these are easy to manipulate. And OI, you can have a baby who's on, you know, certain mean airway pressure, certain amount of oxygen, you'll have an OI. That same baby can now be on nitric oxide, sildenafil, sedated, muscle relaxed, vasopressin, epi, and they still have the same OI. It's just far too simplistic. So using OI 40s or 60s or whatever the number is, I think is, you know, too simplistic. I can tell you at our center, Gunner's actually helped move the needle in my brain. I was always one of these guys where ECMO was the enemy. You want to avoid ECMO as much as you can. And Dr. Gunner's tried to convince me over time quite successfully that no, it's not the enemy and it's something we need to pull the trigger on much more quickly. I do believe everything I'm telling you right now is about plus or minus 10%. I do believe national standard for going on ECMO is 45% plus or minus 5%, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Our center has traditionally been 20%. Is it because we're so keen on hemodynamics? Maybe, but more so, we always thought of ECMO as the enemy and you want to avoid it at all costs. But I think more and more, we're starting to pull the trigger now early, particularly with Dr. Gunner. He's so easy to approach, so easy to call any time of night. And oftentimes, again, it's kind of funny. He's asking me to go on ECMO when I'm telling him to hold off. And it's just, it's a cool dynamic. It's a cool conversation. There is no right answer, but we've started to pull the trigger more and more. I actually don't think that's the hard question, when to go on. I mean, yes, I didn't give you an answer, but I think a harder question that I've been struggling with is when to come off of ECMO and when to do the surgical repair on or off ECMO. Again, this is one of those things that I thought I knew the answer. And the more and more I do it, the more and more confused I become.
Certainly.
So the initiation of ECMO, again, it's important that one tracks these patients in your own center, in your own hands as a team. And if you understand the phenotype of that patient, then you can kind of make that decision. Now we have, you know, we have written guidelines. It's available on SIO journals through ELSO. You guys can all look up those numbers. But to be honest with you, the numbers are numbers. And knowing it, and this is kind of like, you know, I love making pizza, okay? It's so hard to make good pizza at home. And I don't want to compare and distill this down to that, but it's a metaphor. And no matter how many YouTube videos you watch on how to make a pizza, it just never works out the same way. Yes. And because it's just a lot of little things that go into it. And when to go on ECMO for diaphragmatic hernia, it's so immensely complex. But I do agree that we don't need to let patients fail. It's not just about having a high lactate for more than 4 hours or preductal FiO2 being less than 85% for more than 4 hours. And please recognize that what I said earlier is critical, that most babies nowadays are teetering on multiple medications to be relatively stable, but then at least a lot of better trauma over time and chronic lung disease and et cetera. So I think there's some component of not recognizing that. And then if they crash, you have no buffer.
What I gather from what you're telling me today is that when we have those sick patients at the bedside with CDH or perhaps failing, we need all of the key players at the bedside in the conversation early, maybe led by our local experts to make what we think is the best decision for the patient in that moment. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, and that happens over time. When Amir and I first started, like, we weren't those people. We have slowly become those people. We can pay a lot of homage to Dr. Cleary, who's passed away this last year. But, you know, he brought us up to that level over time. But we text each other all the time, group text.
Yeah.
About everything, just 5, 6, 7 of us. And it's really helpful to have that team dynamic and communication. At that level, there's no neonatologist or surgeon. We're just all just doctors taking care of a patient.
I have one more question about ECMO before we move on. My understanding is these patients certainly have respiratory and cardiovascular reasons to go on ECMO. And my understanding is that the overwhelming majority of these are supported with VA ECMO. I feel like there's a subset of patients who likely have primarily gas exchange issues. And if we corrected that with VV, it might be able to support them. And my question is, what do you see the role of VV ECMO in these patients?
Again, this is a question that if you ask people in Emory or people at CHOP versus Michigan versus CHOC, you might get different answers. Clearly, it doesn't make a difference if you can do both right. So VV is easier in many ways because it's a single cannula, but you're limited by the baby's neck veins, you know, baby size. So it's not always physically possible, but it's possible. And we weren't able to do it for a while since the adequate cannula wasn't available. Now there is one available. VA is easier because it's just more straightforward because they're just more sizes of cannulas and it's easier to go on. But then a different question, like not every baby needs a 7-day run. Some need a 3-, 4-, 5-week run. That's what Amir is talking about. It's hard to do a VA ECMO run for so long because of the complications that go along with, I guess, embolic events primarily. And it's very hard to convert from VA to VV. It's almost near impossible. I mean, it can be done, but it's just, especially after a long run. Those centers who do VV and they're very good at doing VV, they know, and then you can always convert to VA. That's probably the better way to do it in my mind. We're not that center. I think we're mostly a VA center. We have been. Maybe we'll evolve to being a more VV center. And then some people have used a cephalic drainage cannula, but I think some studies have shown that that's not always helpful or it could have other complications. So I'm not the right person to ask because my VV experience for CDH is relatively low. Mm-hmm. However, I have written some papers on that topic, and clearly I can tell you that if retrospective studies and also data, of course, can be criticized, but there's no difference in those studies. Interpreted as educated as you can based on data quality.
Perfect. Dr. Ashrafi, anything to add to that?
No, that's everything.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as a replacement for medical advice. It's also worth noting that the views expressed during this episode by me, Zach, and our guests are our own and do not reflect the official position of our institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to help support the production of Pete's Crit, you can find us on Venmo and Patreon. We've also had some light merch made in the form of Pete's Crit laptop stickers. And if you include a mailing address with any contribution, we would be so excited to send you one. Thank you again for listening. You know, Zach.
Oh, this is part two.